We are ready to begin, and I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's library colloquium. I am Mary Black Junton, and I'm the music librarian here and have been for a good many years. So I probably know some of you from standing behind the reference desk in there. And it's my pleasure to welcome Harlan Jennings as our speaker tonight. He's associate professor of voice who came to Michigan State in 1973. He has performance credits that include many performances in opera, oratorio, music theater, a half dozen solo recitals on PBS, and he has a CD called Crosslights of American Song as his most recent CD with Ann Nispel, and we have two copies of that in the library if anyone is interested over in Fine Arts to check that out and enjoy hearing some wonderful American music. Dr. Jennings holds a musical arts degree from the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati and has published over a dozen articles on opera in the American West. His writings have appeared in numerous scholarly journals such as the Opera Quarterly, Proteus, and the American National Biography, Sonic Society Bulletin, and several other historical society journals from the Midwest. He's been the recipient of several grants from Michigan State University and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And currently, under the auspices of the University of Illinois Press, he is writing a book on the history of 19th century grand opera on the Central Plains from St. Louis to Denver. His presentation tonight is entitled, with apologies to Gilbert and Sullivan, An Impresario's Lot is Not a Happy One. Now we should all sing the right chorus. So, Dr. Jennings.
Thank you, Mary, for that introduction. Before we go any further, I would like to thank two gentlemen who have, without whose help this event would not be possible. Michael Rodriguez and John Shaw, who've been very helpful in getting this thing set up and have made themselves available for a number of hours to get this thing underway. Before we begin, I would like to state that the next colloquium in this series under the rubric of Music in American Life is already set for April 17th, 2013. And I'm very pleased to say that the speaker that evening will be Dr. Marcy Ray. That's Wednesday, April 17th, 7 p.m., 2013. Okay, Her Majesty's Opera Company in Kansas City, 1884 to 86. This was piloted by the charismatic James Henry Mapleson, British impresario. He made three visits to Kansas City, Missouri in the mid-1980s. We've got a slide of him, courtesy of the Harvard Theater Collection. His base of operations in this country was the New York Academy of Music. And he was, at this time, 1884, locked in a duel for operatic supremacy with Henry Abbey's Grand Italian Opera Company, based at the newly opened Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. In the fall of 1883, the battleground had been New York. Now, however, the opera war had come to the American heartland, as the two operatic commanders maneuvered their forces on a cross-country campaign in the winter of 1884 and exacted tribute in turn from the same cities. On February 23rd, Mapleson's forces were concentrated on the west bank of the Mississippi River at St. Louis. And here I will try my skill at a freehand map of the central part of the country. I always have to start with the state of Kansas, otherwise I can't draw Missouri. Part of that has to do, I suppose, with being born in Kansas. Okay, so that's Kansas, and Missouri looks something like this. And as we will discover, Mapleson's has been here in St. Louis earlier in February, and now he's got to get out here to Kansas City. And the most direct route would be the Missouri Pacific Rail Line, I believe it is, which would cruise down here below the Missouri River. And ordinarily, you could get there in about 12 hours. But as we'll see, that didn't exactly happen. So, February 23rd, Mapleson is still in St. Louis. During the week of February 18th, Mapleson's company had easily outdrawn Henry Abbey's, whose troupe had visited the city earlier in the month. With the news of Abbey's mounting losses in all the newspapers, Mapleson sensed that a bold stroke would solidify the victory that finally seemed within his grasp. A veteran of four U.S. tours, the impresario had never taken his company further west than the gateway city he currently occupied. He'd come there as early as 1879. Now, however, Mapleson decided to stake his financial fortunes on a march overland to San Francisco, and he determined to finance his passage west with performances in major cities along his proposed route, Kansas City being the first. It was a risky venture. Mapleson's troupe left St. Louis at 1 a.m., February 24th, on one of the most magnificent trains that ever crossed the continent. And here's a breakdown. The OPA train consisted of two baggage cars, two day coaches near the front of the train for the chorus, one Pullman sleeper occupied by the orchestra, two man boudoir cars for the principal singers, named appropriately La Traviata and La Sonnambula, and one special car, Lycoming, reserved for Mapleson, his very good friend, soprano Louise Dotti, and soprano Itelka Gerster and her husband. Legendary soprano Adelina Patti, who'd been with on Mapleson's tour, here's a slide of her. Patti remained in St. Louis with the agreement that she would rejoin Mapleson in Denver within a few days. Members of the troupe were issued ornate souvenir programs of the trip, listing scheduled arrival and departure times for various towns along the route. The programs were adorned with the following title page: Her Majesty's Opera Company, from the Father of Waters through the Golden Horn to the Silver Lake via the popular Burlington route, Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad. Before the troupe could pull out of the St. Louis Depot, however, the fates intervened to undermine the projected timetable. A bridge collapsed, forcing the special train to make a 120-mile detour across southern Iowa. Expected to arrive at 4 p.m. February 24th, Mapleson did not reach Kansas City until 2 a.m. February 25th, which happened to be the day of the opening performance. Ongoing poker games helped pass the time on the train as the party bowled merrily along at the rate of 30 miles per hour. That was considered quite fast in those days. A Kansas City Times reporter lost the equivalent of over $200 to soprano Louise Dotti, Mapleson's friend. Dotti had feigned a lack of familiarity with cards. Here she is. She's born in Rochester, Massachusetts. She looks like a pleasant lady. But apparently you didn't want to take her on in a poker game. Finding himself among a gaggle of reporters who had boarded the train at Marysville, Missouri, Mapleson issued the following challenge to the territories beyond the Mississippi. This is my first attempt to introduce grand opera in the West. If I lose money, that settles grand opera in the West, so far as I am concerned. If I come out even, they shall have more and soon. Despite Mapleson's claims that he was bringing 100 people to Kansas City, his company probably numbered closer to 85, of whom about 75 were actual combatants. Still, his was a sizable organization to keep on the road and easily the largest to enter Kansas City up to this time. Here's a list of the personnel. The orchestra had been reduced to approximately 20 individuals, down from the 32 who had played in St. Louis. He detached about 58 people prior to leaving for Kansas City and sent them back to New York City to save money. The chorus now numbered 35 to 40 singers, and there were 16 principals. In addition to the impresario, the following personnel comprised the balance of the troupe: a music director, conductor, assistant conductor, chorus master, master of the pianoforte, harpist, principal dancer, stage manager, armorer, business manager, treasurer, controller, and a private secretary. The entourage also included two executives from the railroad, as well as Gerster's husband and her two maids. Prima donnas must have maids, as you know. Shortly after the much fatigued Mapleson organization arrived in the wee hours, it bedded down in various locations around town. The more prosperous members of the troupe took rooms in downtown hotels, while Mapleson quartered the chorus in their rail cars at the depot, another cost-saving measure. That evening, February 25th, 1884, an audience of slightly over 1,000 was present to hear the local Italian premiere of Bellini's La Sonnambula, starring the exquisite Hungarian soprano Itelka Gerster. And here's a sketch from one of the Kansas City newspapers of an audience assembling approximately of 1871. But you can get some idea of what they wore and a little bit of what it looked like at the interior of the Gillis Opera House. At least 150 of those attending were from small outlying towns in Kansas and Missouri, which in those days were easily accessible by rail. They could get to the end of town quite easily. When the performance was over, there would be special trains waiting for the opera people to take them back to these various outlying towns. It wasn't Amtrak. In its review, the Kansas City Times proudly proclaimed, quote, "Italian opera has made its bow to Kansas City, and it is safe to say that in the future, Italian opera will find a welcome whenever it comes," end of quote. It was reported that more than $3,000 had come into the box office, and that's the modern equivalent of approximately $60,000. And everyone, it seemed, was ecstatic about Gerster, the prima donna. Up to this point, things had been going reasonably well for Mapleson. However, with Patti temporarily on sabbatical, he had only one star soprano, Gerster, and she could not sing every night. This did not bode well in an arena where the majority of the public was more interested in hearing famous singers than in witnessing opera for its own sake. There were some changes, unfortunately. Rigoletto with Lillian Nordica as Gilda had originally been on the bill for the second evening, February 26th. However, Nordica was somewhere in the east, hundreds of miles from Kansas City. There's no evidence, in fact, that she had even accompanied Mapleson any further than Chicago. Therefore, one can only assume that Colonel Mapleson, in his advertisements, had been rather careless with the facts in order to sell tickets, a not uncommon defect among impresarios. At a late date, it was finally revealed that Nordica had left Mapleson's troupe and would be replaced by Louise Dotti, Mapleson's all-purpose soprano, ungenerously referred to as, quote, the ever-to-be-endured Madame Dotti by author and critic George C.D. O'Dell. To make matters worse, another surprise was in store for the public. At some point during the day of the second performance, the opera was changed from Rigoletto to La Favorita because it was announced Dotti had not recovered sufficiently from a lingering cold. Mapleson named mezzo-soprano Maria Bianchi Fiorio as the new diva of the evening. Only a small audience turned out to hear the local premiere of Donizetti's opera. This time, the reviews were not so positive. The Times was especially disappointed in Bianchi Fiorio, grumbling that Mapleson needed a distinguished mezzo to draw an audience in Kansas City. Referring to her rendition of the famous aria, O Mio Fernando, the Times sneered, amateurs have sung it better. End of quote. Mapleson must have departed with mixed feelings about his success, as the poor attendance of the second evening surely put him in the red. With slim prospects for profit at his next stop, St. Joseph, Missouri, Mapleson was perhaps already staking his hopes on the silver magnates of Colorado, where Horace Tabor and his fellow Denverites eagerly awaited the Colonel's inaugural appearance in that city, February 29th. Now we turn to Mapleson's 1885 engagement. This also took place in February. As had been the case in 1884, the British impresario was headed for San Francisco, and Kansas City constituted the first leg of his westward advance. This time it appeared that fortune had decided not to interfere with the Colonel's peaceful progress toward the Pacific coast. His troop closed a week's engagement in St. Louis, and unlike the previous February, completed the rail journey across Missouri without any delays, so that the company arrived a full 24 hours before its scheduled opening at the Coates Opera House this time. And here's a slide of the Coates. Of course, it's no longer there, having long, no, I was going to say it had been demolished, but that's not right. It burned down in 1901. While the Mapleson troupe was holding forth in St. Louis, the Kansas City Times, with characteristic impishness, had kept an eye on news emanating from its sister city, occasionally identifying tidbits susceptible to its bantering style. And here's a quote from the Times. Madame Patti, the $4,500 songbird, is out of sorts. There were too many empty chairs on her night in St. Louis. It takes $6 to hear Patti in a comfortable way, which is almost enough to purchase a ton of coal. There are a great many people in St. Louis who can get up more enthusiasm over a hot fire at home than by listening to Patti during the development of a blizzard. Either Patti must come down or the thermometer must go up. End of quote. During his 1884 Western tour, Mapleson had possessed two drawing cards, his world-class sopranos Adelina Patti and Itelka Gerster. They were also his most expensive employees. Patti, regarded as the world's leading soprano, was particularly aware of her worth, demanding from Mapleson as much as $5,000 per night, to be brought to her dressing room in advance of the performance, or she wouldn't go on. Therefore, Mapleson could not afford to put Patti before the public without exacting a guarantee from the local opera house. And for this reason, Patti had not sung in Kansas City in 1884, nor would she in 1885, much to the disappointment, as you would surely imagine, of many of the Kansas City citizenry. Aside from Adelina Patti, the singer Kansas Cityans most desired to hear was American soprano Emma Navetta, New York's latest diva darling. As well versed as it seems to have been regarding Mapleson's troupe, the Kansas City Times apparently was unaware that Emma Navetta had come down with a cold in St. Louis. Dispatches from that city would have revealed that, although Navetta had appeared in a performance of Sonnambula February 9th, she had been unable to sing Gounod's Mirella February 12th and had canceled her Lucia of February 14th. Nonetheless, she was still being advertised to appear opening night when Mapleson's entourage arrived in Kansas City. The impresario had announced a brief season of two performances, Lucia di Lammermoor, starring Emma Navetta, and a production of Il Trovatore the following evening. February 16th, the day of the opening, dawned bitterly cold in Kansas City. I now quote from the Kansas City Star. Colonel Mapleson's opera company stayed indoors about as much as it could. Some of the signors and counts looked outside of their hotels and took a turn half around the block and then came back and talked enthusiastically of the bracing atmosphere and the delightful climate. But the majority found the atmosphere of the hotel good enough for everyday use, and whatever qualities it lacked were easily made up by the young men in charge of the tap room. The hotel billiard room was occupied most of the day by members of the company, who played pool fairly well and talked Italian furiously. The husbands, agents, private secretaries, and managers of the prime donne lounged about the corridors of the hotel, swore about delayed baggage, issued orders to the hotel clerks, and put in their time as pleasantly as they knew how. Colonel Mapleson was busy answering telegrams, listening to complaints, and holding conferences with the agents of the prime donne. Matters were progressing quietly when a catastrophe occurred. End of quote. At 4 p.m., Emma Navetta's father rushed up to Mapleson and told him that his daughter would not be able to sing that night. The colonel dashed to the soprano's room to confirm the bad news. Miss Navetta was asked to sing a few high notes, but she could not. Faced with the prospect of having to change the opening night bill in late afternoon, Mapleson rushed back to the lobby and called an impromptu conference with his lieutenants. The impresario suggested that the order of the operas be reversed so that the troupe would open with Trovatore and delay Lucia until the following night. Some members of his cabinet, however, advised against this course of action, pointing out that two audiences would be inconvenienced instead of one. Someone else recommended that the company substitute Rigoletto for Lucia. This would allow Trovatore to remain on the second night's bill, thereby avoiding possible offense to that evening's ticket holders. After further discussion, Mapleson put out the word that the opening night's production would be changed to Rigoletto with Louise Dotti, his designated stopgap soprano, as Gilda. So we'll take one more. Well, now that's there she is. There's Dotti, and now a list of the intervention of the fates who were destined to play havoc with Mapleson's performance schedule. With the entire company now gearing up for Rigoletto, Mel Hudson, manager of the Coates Opera House, arrived at the hotel. More consultations followed. At length, It was determined to open with Trovatore instead of Rigoletto. So at 6 p.m., new instructions were issued to the company, and Dotti, who had been ordered to get into costume and makeup for Gilda, was told to cease and desist. Nevada is the attraction, manager Hudson explained. She may be able to sing Tuesday night, she cannot sing now, and the public will be less disappointed over reversing the pills than if we shut out all possibility of hearing Nevada by keeping Trovatore for Tuesday night. Half an hour late, at 8:30, the curtain went up on Verdi's Il Trovatore, featuring Emma Fourchemade as Leonora. Fourchemade was a French soprano who had a very successful career. And as you can sing, she sang off and on at the Met during what turned out to be the last 11 years of her life, from 1883 to 1894. There she is, looking rather formidable, perhaps decked out in the costume as the Queen of Sheba in Goldmark's opera. And this slide is also from the Harvard, yes, it says Harvard Theater Collection. Unlike the previous year, Adelina Patti had come to Kansas City with the rest of Mabelson's troupe. Since the company's arrival the night before, she had remained secluded in her posh private rail car at the depot. Now, however, with a sense of timing honed by years upon the stage, the diva emerged to steal the spotlight from her colleagues. Her arrival at the theater at the close of the first act was calculated to attract the maximum amount of attention. Here is another quote from the Kansas City Star. Leaning on the arm of Colonel Kersey Coates, he was the owner of the theater and also the hotel across the street, she made her way down the aisle leading to the left proscenium box amidst a storm of applause rarely heard in an opera house. Reaching the box, she saluted the audience, at which the storm broke out afresh. Quiet was at last restored, only to be broken by the appearance an hour later of the Reverend Robert Laird Collier in the diva's box. The reverend gentleman arose with Madame Patti and again presented her to the audience, at which people cheered and confusion reigned until the curtain was rung up. With regard to the performance that took place on stage, it seems to have been eminently successful, a couple of minor complaints excepted. One of these concerned the ubiquitous voice of the prompter. Here's still another quote from the Kansas City Star. If it were possible for the singers to learn their parts so as not to have to resort to the old Methodistic way of having the hymn lined out to them, the opera would at least be over sooner, even if the audience did lose a little amusement. Last night, the lining out process was more than usually marked and diverting. In the midst of an impassioned song, the artist would stop, hold his note fiercely, and make a dreadfully dramatic rush to the side of the stage where the prompter was positioned. We respectfully suggest that this part of the program hereafter be omitted. End of quote. The tenor, Franco Cardinale, also came in for a bit of criticism. He has a very robust voice. This is another quote from one of the local journals. He has a very robust voice marred by excessive vibrato and a disagreeable and slovenly style of vocalization. His first number, the Serenade in Trovatore, was execrable. In the concerted music, he appeared to better advantage, and the explosive high C in the Di quella pira, of course, brought him a recall. That's an encore. It always does. There is something about a high C that makes an audience forget all its other troubles. End of quote. The receipts for Trovatore totaled $2,500, well below the amount necessary to afford Adelina Patti. That's $2,500, of course, in of 1883 or 84 of figures. And if you want to get a rough idea, multiply it by 20. So that would be $50,000 was taken in at the box office. But Patti was, of course, expecting $5,000 in advance or 100,000 smackers. And she, Mabelson knew that he couldn't draw that size of an audience in Kansas City. On the evening of February 17th, Mabelson changed the announced repertoire again, substituting Sonnambula, an opera regarded as being less taxing on Nevada's voice, for Lucia. And we'll bring up this other slide. So this is the last change that Mabelson effects in 1885. Emma Nevada received a tremendous ovation from the audience, largely, the journal critic surmised, on the strength of her being an American rather than on her performance, for it was obvious that she was not herself vocally. Her Majesty's Opera Company left Kansas City the next day, February 18th, bound for Topeka, Kansas, where Mabelson would have his first encounter with the women's temperance movement. But that's another story. Mabelson's 1886 Kansas City engagement. Here's a slide of Lilia Nordica. We'll start with her. As the slide says, she was one of the American pioneer divas, if you want to call her that. And she had a fabulous career. Operatic debut in La Scala, singing Don Elvira, 1879. Paris opera debut, Marguerite in Faust, 1882. 5 years later, London debut, Covent Garden, Violetta and Traviata. Bayreuth, Elsa and Lohengrin, 1894. That was her Bayreuth debut. She was a regular at the Met for 15 years, from 1893 to 1908. Singing mostly Wagnerian roles. Another photo here, courtesy of the Harvard Theater Collection. She died a few years after that. She was on a world tour. She was in the East Indies and contracted pneumonia somewhere around Borneo or Singapore or somewhere in there, or perhaps Australia, and died a few weeks later. If memory serves, on board ship. For those of you who are opera aficionados, there is a very fine museum of Lilia Nordica in her hometown, Farmington, Maine. I've been there a couple of times. And if you go there, it's quite cheap, and it's quite entertaining. You can see some of her Wagnerian costumes, which are quite impressive. She's got the brass breastplate, and her spear is there, and her helmet with horns, and a number of commendations from or letters from various famous people, and of course her collection of jewelry. It's within striking distance of Boston if you find yourself there someday and you're looking for something to do. You can run up there in probably 3 or 4 hours and see what there is to see and get back in time for a fairly late dinner. Anyway, Her Majesty's Opera Company was back in Kansas City. A year later, as I said, arriving March 7th, 1886. With Mabelson was soprano Lilia Nordica, now back in Mabelson's camp despite her alleged bad behavior 2 years earlier. Reporters who approached Miss Nordica on the train in Missouri found her engrossed, appropriately, in a copy of Huckleberry Finn. The tour's other leading soprano, the sometimes tempestuous Minnie Hawk, did not travel with the rest of the company. Instead, she and her husband, the Baron von Hesse-Wartek, arrived on a different train the following morning, the morning of the opening, as it turned out. She also had an illustrious career. She was raised near Kansas City. More about that in a second. She sang the title role in the British and American premieres of Bizet's opera, which both occurred in 1878. She was also, America's first Juliet in 1867 when, as you can see, she was at the ripe old age of 15 or 16, depending on when her birthday occurred in 1851. She was also America's first Manon in Massenet's opera. She premiered that role in the States in 1885. A few years later, she also sang the first Santuzza in Cavalleria in Chicago. She sang at the Met one season only. She made her operatic debut at age 14 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Very young to make an opera debut, younger even than most of her contemporaries, although most of them, if you look at the historical record, debuted at a much earlier age than our sopranos do now. It was not uncommon to have a debut at 17, 18, or 19. Minnie Hawk I'll move over here to this marvelous freehand map. She was born in New York City, but she spent part of her childhood her mother ran a boarding house here along, not far from Kansas City, she was actually in Kansas, between Atchison and Leavenworth, somewhere in here. And so she grew up there. Her mother ran a boarding house and her father worked for a shipbuilding or a boat building company there. In 1860 or 61, right before the Civil War, there was a big flood on the Missouri. The Missouri, as you know, is the longest river in North America and flows down here. It forms the part of the border between Iowa and Nebraska for a while and then goes on up into South Dakota. There was a big flood and their place was washed away. So the father decided to, what else, build a boat and go to New Orleans. So he was a builder and apparently a designer, and he was able to put together a small side wheeler, and they set out and they made it the approximately 450 river miles down to St. Louis without incident. But here they went into the Mississippi, and just below St. Louis, they had a very serious accident. They were rammed by a regular packet or steamer. Their little boat sank. They lost all their possessions, but luckily, Minnie's father and mother and Minnie herself were not hurt. They were rescued by the riverboat captain who discovered them hanging on to pieces of wood drifting down the river. And so he took them on down to New Orleans free of charge. So she wound up there in 1861, and the Civil War broke out. She sang for a benefit for the relief of war sufferers and wounded soldiers. Some influential people heard her. This happened in 1862, so she was still quite young, and they put up a bunch of money to send her to New York for study. So she got on a ship with her parents. They ran the Union blockade, sailed around Key West and up the East Coast and into New York City, and She started studying in New York, and as the slide says, eventually made the right contacts and attracted the attention of the right people, and made her debut at the Brooklyn Academy at a very young age. She although she married quite well, she was married to the Baron Hesse von Wartek and assembled quite a fortune. During World War I, due to the tremendous depreciation of German currency, she lost it all. And when word reached the United States at the end of the war that she was destitute, living in desperate circumstances, the famous mezzo-soprano Geraldine Farrar headed up a fundraising effort to take care of her, a successful fundraising effort in 1919 to take care of Miss Hauck in her old age. And she lived another 10 years. Okay, so Hauck has arrived on March 8th, and that evening she's supposed to open Mapleson's season with Carmen. Sometime after the couple's arrival, a visitor showed up at the office of the Kansas City Journal. It was Baron Wartek, who had dropped by to assert that there was no truth to the story that his wife had scratched tenor Luigi Ravelli on stage during a Chicago performance of Carmen some days earlier. To a Times reporter, Miss Hauck denied that there'd been another disagreement with Ravelli in St. Louis. At the same time, Mapleson offered assurances that there would be no sudden changes in repertoire this time. Mapleson's prediction proved correct. Carmen sung in Italian and starring Minnie Hauck with Luigi Ravelli as Don José and Louise Dotti as Micaela opened as scheduled at the Gillis. One can imagine Mapleson's holding his breath as the fatal confrontation between Carmen and José in Act Four approached. Luckily, his artists were on good behavior, and the scene, as well as the rest of Bizet's opera, passed without incident. Now, here I've got a Carmen program from St. Louis the previous week, which was where Mapleson's troupe had sung. They were at the Olympic Theater. There are, aside from just who was singing what, there's some other interesting aspects to this. You can see that it was a different Don José. Micaela was still singing, still being sung by Dotti. Giuseppe del Puente was the Escamillo, as he was in Kansas City. But look there at the top, right above Carmen, it says Saturday, March 6th at 2 p.m. That's a matinee, isn't it? We didn't always have matinees in this country. St. Louis had not had any theater matinees until May 22nd, 1857. That was the first one. It was a concert with the famous pianist Thalberg and some singers who were supporting him, Teresa Parodi and Adelina Patti's older sister, Amalia, who was a fine lyric mezzo-soprano. Anyway, prior to May of 1857, there had been no matinees in St. Louis. Matinees were created so that women could go unaccompanied to the theater. They could go with other women, or they could bring children, so forth. Prior to this time, women were not allowed in theaters unless they were accompanied by a gentleman. In fact, this was very strict policy stated in the St. Louis papers when the charter for the St. Louis Theater was worked out in 1837 and passed through the Missouri legislature. And of course, the reason for not allowing unaccompanied women in the theater was that ladies of the PAV tended to show up, and the respectable ladies did not want to associate or be in a theater with these other types. So that was 1857, a matinee. Kansas City did not have any matinees until, I think the first one was about 20 years later, 1879. So it was still a relatively new thing in Kansas City to have a matinee. In any event, you'll notice that there's, right here, we've got a ballerina. Mapleson always traveled with a lead dancer and a small ballet corps. We've got a plug for Steinway pianos. And then there's a notice that the only true, real, reliable edition of the opera libretto can be purchased inside the theater. You wouldn't want to go down to so-and-so's drugstore or the local music store for a libretto, because that's not going to be authentic. You've got to buy it inside the theater. What else does it say here? Oh, the pianos used in the theater, here's a plug for the local music store, are from the house of blah, 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 wholesale and retail dealers in pianos and organs, and gives the address. Anyway, Carmen came off without incident. The following evening, March 10th, Mapleson played his other soprano card, Lilia Nordica, featuring her in Faust. Nordica, her future luminescence, not yet a reality, did not make a very strong impression. The Times found her stage demeanor more appropriate for concert work and judged the future Wagnerian's voice too light for Marguerite. Faust did not draw as well as Carmen. The journal's explanation for this was that Nordica was not known. The poor attendance was a blow to Mapleson's already precarious finances, prompting the colonel to vow that he would not return to Kansas City without a guarantee. Ahead of Mapleson lay Topeka, St. Joseph, Missouri, Denver, Cheyenne, Salt Lake City, and San Francisco. As the veteran impresario, in a desperate gamble to save his opera company, waged his last campaign across the American West. Unfortunately, the colonel's third visit to Kansas City proved his last. Mapleson's financial house of cards soon collapsed. With the departure of this intrepid, wily, and urbane impresario, one of the most colorful chapters in the history of America's lyric stage came to an end. Thank you for listening. Thanks very much. Thank you. If anyone has any questions, I'll try to answer them. Oh, one other thing, and then I'll get to Professor Dr. Hall. Further reading. There's unfortunately no printed material on any of this except the material that's been written by Harlan Jennings. And so here's a short list, and knowing many of you of scholarly bent and what dedicated students you are, you will probably, realizing that there are copies of the Opera Quarterly in the stacks just a few feet away from this very room, will probably want to forego the food and make a mad dash over there to catch up on your reading. But some of you may not, and you can check these out, investigate them at some other time. Dr. Hall.
Harlan, where was this great battle royal between Mapleson and Abbey? I didn't quite pick up on that in your lecture as two competing impresarios. Where did Abbey come into this?
Well, it all started, Mapleson had been using the New York Academy of Music as his base of operations in New York City. He would bring his London troupe over, And he'd play a London season and then come to New York, usually in the fall. And he'd been the only show in town since about 1878. And then this blasted, newly minted Metropolitan Opera House came on the scene and opened, if memory serves, in October 1883. And so suddenly there was this huge fight for box office revenue between Mapleson's group at the Academy of Music and Henry Abbey's group at the Metropolitan. To make matters worse, there was a kind of bidding war for the top flight talent as well. And singers like Adelina Patti would be on Mapleson's team for a while, and then Abby would put in a bid and she'd go over there. And so there was a certain amount of competition there. And then usually these seasons in New York would run a couple of months in those days at the Academy of Music and before that at the previous opera house. I'm drawing a blank on it right now. They'd run maybe into December, and then after a couple of months of seasoning, these troops, New York-based troops, would go on the road. And they'd go sometimes as far as over the Alleghenies, and eventually, once there was a more or less complete network of railroads in place in the Midwest, which occurred well before the Civil War, there was a rail line in position in what is now East St. Louis in 1854. You still had to take a ferry across the Mississippi River to get to St. Louis, but you could go by train pretty much all the way to East St. Louis in 1854 from New York by that time. And there were ever more railroads, of course, thereafter. And even in Missouri, there were rail lines. There was a line completed from St. Louis to Sedalia by 1861. The Civil War shut down any further construction on that until 1865. But in 1859, there was a line that went from Hannibal to St. Joe. And the Pony Express took off from there. I seem to have John Shaw's. I'm afraid I've stolen your marker, or at least mislaid it. You'll get it back. But Saint Joe was up here, and Hannibal was over here, and so there was a line across here in 1859, and. Here they could hook up with the Pony Express. So about April 1st, 1860, mail went out all the way to Sacramento. And then, of course, the Golden Spike, which really wasn't a Golden Spike. It would have shattered if it been made of gold, hit by a sledgehammer. But the story of the storied Golden Spike was driven in 1869 in Utah. And then you could go by rail all the way to San Francisco. Mapleson and Abbey went on tour and were hitting different cities at different times. And as I said, Abbey had a disaster in St. Louis. Mapleson seems to have made money. That was the competition. Both of them eventually returned to New York City. Abbey certainly did, and for a spring season there. Hope that answers your question. Mapleson stayed in competition with Abbey in subsequent years, but in 1886, he eventually went under and the Met won out.
So how did Kansas City respond to this competition with rival companies and impresarios?
Well, there really wasn't any competition in Kansas City between the two, because Henry Abbey, after having been burned in St. Louis, turned back and headed east. and didn't go out there. It's interesting, though, this was 1886, Mapleson's last tour, when Patti still could not sing because the proper guarantee could not be raised. 1 year later, she did come out. Henry Abbey was managing her tour. It was a concert tour this time. She had an orchestra of about 20 people. She was supported by, it wasn't a full opera company, so this is a much less expensive operation to run. She was sang in Kansas City, one performance at in February of 87. As I said, Henry Abbey was her manager now, and he made money on it because they were able to do it in a new venue called Merchants Exchange Hall, which seated several thousand people, and they were able to fill it and make enough money to pay her and still at least break even. And interestingly enough, the manager was of the Merchants Exchange Hall, this new hall, just happens to have been Corydon Craig, who had resurfaced after being dismissed the previous August from the Gillis. Any other questions? Everybody's hungry. Okay, thanks very much. Thank you.